Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this conversation on the right on the future of the SEC and cryptocurrency. Our panelists are Justin Clark, Paul Watkins, and Eric Wesson. Justin Clark is the civil chief for the Kentucky Office of the Attorney General. Justin manages the office's civil division. He previously served as a litigator in the Attorney General's office. Paul Watkins is the managing partner of Fusion Law PLLC. He helped found the first global regulatory innovation coalition, the Global Financial Innovation Network, and led the founding of the first U.S. regulatory innovation coalition, American Consumer Financial. He's also the chair of the Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group at the Federalist Society. Eric Wesson serves as Iowa Solicitor General in the Iowa Attorney General's office. In that role, Wesson leads Iowa's litigation before state and federal appellate courts, including the Iowa and U.S. Supreme Courts. Our moderator today is Katie Biber. Katie is Chief Legal Officer at Paradigm, leading the firm's legal, regulatory, compliance, and policy functions. Previously, Katie was Chief Legal Officer at Brex, a fintech startup reimagining financial systems for growing companies. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Katie, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Caroline, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. Hopefully, it'll be a fun discussion. I want to set the table by saying it's been an eventful few days with respect to crypto litigation. We've had OpenSea, Robinhood, and Coinbase all publicly announce that the SEC intends to withdraw its litigation against those companies. And today we added Uniswap to that list. This really puts us squarely in the final chapter, I think, of the SEC's seeming war against the crypto industry, directed by Gary Gensler, but really inspired by the political views of Elizabeth Warren. During the Clayton administration at the SEC, during the last Trump administration, crypto was not getting a free pass. There was heavy scrutiny of things like ICOs and no significant progress on regulatory clarity or licensing. But the one big difference is the Clayton SEC was listening to the industry, was learning, and was taking the initial steps that you might hope a regulatory agency would take to learn about new technology. This all changed when Joe Biden won in 2020 and put Gary Gensler in as chair at the SEC. If you're not familiar with the progressive enforcement philosophy of folks like Chairman Gensler, it can best be articulated like this. Regulators and prosecutors should stop playing it safe. They should take bold action. They should try to move the Overton window. Their job is not to preserve due process, but it's to win at all costs, to push the boundaries. In short, the mantra is, if you are not losing cases, you're not bringing enough aggressive cases. You know, it's interesting. This approach may actually ultimately have cost Joe Biden the election because it activated and it electrified the crypto industry in a way that probably wasn't going to be possible for Trump. It also probably played a role in lighting up tech CEOs of all stripes across Silicon Valley and across the country and opening folks' eyes to what we like to call the vast sprawl of the administrative state. So during that time, a lot of litigation was brought against the SEC by private litigants. And there was also a big case brought by a number of state attorneys general, which we'll be focusing here today on. And just to let everyone know, we're going to be taking questions at about the 45-minute mark. So feel free to throw them in the chat anytime, and we will get to them as quickly as I can. All right, so let's get to trying to frame up the first set of questions here. And with that, I want to turn it to Paul Watkins. And Paul, can you just set the table for us? Tell us a little bit about the Howey test, which is the basis of a lot of this litigation that we've been seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for the opportunity to be part of this conversation. So the Howey case is about 80 years old, Supreme Court decision, and it's defining contracts that constitute securities. So the way the 33 Act is structured is there's a list of securities that most of us would expect. You have stocks, you have bonds, you have specific types of those different categories. And then you have something called an investment contract. We know not all contracts, of course, are securities, but if it's an investment contract, then it is. So what Howey is trying to tell us is what are the subsets of contracts that are investment contracts and that are securities. And the court came up with a four-part test. They said you need an investment of money. You need that investment to be in a common enterprise. The investment needs to be made with an expectation of profits. And those profits need to come from the essential entrepreneurial or managerial efforts of others. And I think it's helpful to maybe run through an example of how this might be applied. I think the easiest example is, frankly, a music video. If we think back two decades ago, if you think about Nelly, big boy stomping in his Air Force Ones, are those Air Force Ones a security? And I think that's a closer question, certainly in the minds of the Gary Gensler SEC, than you would think. Because if you go back and you watch that video, and I'm not necessarily recommending it, but if you do, you could watch it with this purpose. The shoes displayed are now selling on eBay for thousands of dollars. They were marketed as collector's items. They were limited edition. People traded money with an expectation of profit, and in fact, they did profit. So the question comes down to the two other elements, and these are the key elements in the SEC litigation. Was there a common enterprise? And did the profits come from the essential activities of others? And here I think it's important to compare the shoe with the company. The difference between buying a Nike shoe and buying a share in Nike. If you're buying a share in Nike, clearly the money's going into that enterprise. Well, if you're buying the shoe, the money's going to Nike too. So we have some similarities there. The key difference is, where is the value coming from? You buy a share of Nike, that share increases in value as the Nike executives make good decisions and grow their company. What about the shoe? That's about supply and demand. That's about the characteristics of the shoe. The shoe is not increasing in value because of the efforts of the Nike executives. Even though the Nike executives are marketing that shoe, they're rolling out products that relate to that shoe. They've rolled out a watch. They've rolled out at one point a little dongle that went on the shoe to tell you how fast it was moving. That doesn't convert the shoe into a security. And another reason that we can tell it's not a security is because we can look at the disclosure regime that the SEC would apply. And we can say, does that disclosure regime help consumers? The SEC disclosure regime is quarterly earnings. It's a balance sheet. It's executive compensation. Does any consumer care about that when they buy a pair of shoes? No, they don't. They want to know, was this endorsed by Michael Jordan? Was it endorsed by Dwayne Wade? And so I think those sorts of criteria are useful in applying to some of this litigation and telling what is properly a security.
And of course, the through line here, right, is that if these crypto tokens are securities, then the exchanges that are allowing them to be traded ought to be registered with the SEC, or at least that was previously the SEC's argument under Chairman Gensler. And Eric, your office got involved in these issues pretty early, I think, and some of the first amicus briefs that were filed, you were involved in. Can you walk us through what some of the litigation trends we've seen from the industry? What cases have been brought and what have been the grounds of those cases?
Yeah, thanks, Katie. And thanks to the Federalist Society for organizing this conversation, which I think is really timely given all of the changes that are going on right now. Before this conversation, we were catching up and there was even more action on the front of various enforcement actions than the SEC announced even this morning. So this is an ongoing and vital issue that affects potentially trillions of dollars in assets. When it comes to affirmative cases and cases brought by industry. Here you have a real situation where the SEC has opted, at least to date, to be the regulator of this industry that Congress never affirmatively gave it explicit authorization to regulate. And as a result, of certain choices the SEC has made in trying to move forward on that front, there has been a cloud of uncertainty that has created real impediments to further development in the industry itself. And what I mean by that is the industry wants to help consumers buy and sell these tokens in a variety of ways. Some companies are offering the tokens. Some of them are just giving them away. Other companies want to be exchanges where these tokens or other crypto assets can be exchanged. And each of those raises its own questions, both as to legality as well as to ensuring proper consumer protection. But rather than engage in a meaningful investigation as to what that entails, the SEC has decided instead just to treat almost all actions in this industry as securities, which imposes massive consequences if certain affirmative acts aren't followed by the people that would be then regulated by the SEC. And the consequence there ranges from various licensing harms to potential monetary punitive penalties to even potential criminal liability in some cases. And so there are real risks. So some companies, and two I'll highlight, one is Legilex, the other is Biba, brought affirmative lawsuits to try to challenge the SEC to explain what the heck it is doing, because what it was doing up to that point was engaging in what could be seen as selective enforcement actions without an underlying principled approach to the regulation. And even if there was some kind of discernible, intelligible principle or approach, it was one that was not being applied in a manner that is consistent with any rules or regulations that had been issued by the SEC. So Legilex wanted to be one of these exchanges, and they, along with the Crypto Freedom Alliance of Texas, sued in Texas to try to push back against the SEC enforcement. They wanted to run their digital asset trading platform, and they did not believe that many of the digital assets that would be traded on that platform would be or should be subject to SEC regulation. But they didn't know, because the SEC hasn't issued any rules. It hasn't explained what its process is, and it hasn't explained how any of these assets clearly fall within Howey. And so why or how the Legilex platform would be able to accommodate the regulations that may or may not apply. That type of gray area is extremely concerning. And Biba, which is founded by, I believe, two immigrants from East Africa that wanted to sell various handmade goods, they decided to just do what's called an airdrop and send tokens to all of their customers. They could be exchanged for discounts on a duffel bag, I think. They were concerned that that act could be seen by the SEC as an unlawful securities offering. Now, it might seem ridiculous to you that a free online token that could be traded for a discount would be a securities violation, but given the way that the SEC has approached its regulation and regulatory approach, it's just not clear. And again, there are massive potential consequences that could follow. So in both of those cases, there were affirmative lawsuits filed to try to clarify the scope of SEC's enforcement authority. And in the Legilex case, a coalition of 15 states, which in a federal district court is a lot of states, filed an amicus brief defending the declaratory judgment action. And I think we'll get into some of the details of that and the underlying purpose later. But right now, the states are paying a whole lot of attention, not only to the enforcement actions brought by, and I guess dropped by the SEC, but also to the affirmative litigation brought by innovative American companies looking to push back as the SEC tries to enter a new regulatory arena without congressional authorization.
Thanks, Eric. That was a really good comprehensive rundown. And you're right. I think the SEC has stretched its jurisdiction beyond recognition over the last few years. And in November of last year, 18 state attorneys general jumped into this conversation by suing the SEC. Justin, why don't you walk us through that case, if you can, and explain to us the types of claims that the states were able to, that the states were able to make that private litigants were not in the position to make.
Yeah. First, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And I'll do my best on that because, you know, like a lot of these lawsuits and complaints, it's obviously a several hundred paragraphs of allegations. And so what I'll focus on is why a state, particularly Kentucky and other states, have an interest here that private entities might not be able to bring. And it somewhat boils down to what Paul and Eric touched on a little bit, that I'll just state very clearly that I don't think has ever happened, that digital assets are just that, they're assets. That's my knowledge. No one has officially ever declared a digital asset a security. They're attempting to regulate it by enforcement. But in Kentucky, like most states, you know, we regulate people and businesses and institutions that are engaged in money transmission. And, you know, in Kentucky, our Department of Financial Institutions have provided specific guidance that money transmitters of digital assets are money transmitters under the statute, which makes sense because digital assets are a medium of exchange. You know, I know people can watch the value rise of certain things, like Paul and Eric would explain on these Bitcoins, but, you know, the thought here is at some point the Bitcoin or the cryptocurrency may be used to buy online goods or even groceries. And so to me, we're dealing with digital assets, you know, not a security. And so from a state interest, you know, obviously we have separation of powers and federalism questions when the federal government, by overregulation, and here it's weird or a little bit odd because we're actually not dealing with a very clear violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, even though they've done that by their actions. They've not really even engaged in the rulemaking process that would necessitate that sort of kind of claim. You know, there's been no comment, there's been no hearings to even put these rules. It's just been that, you know, kind of shoot, see what they kill type of approach. Well, for Kentucky, and I think like all the other states that joined us, but really most states in the union, as I understand it, it's not talked about a lot, but all states deal with escheatment and abandoned property. And so the thing that got my attention when this case, you know, come to me to start reviewing was, well, wait a minute, you know, if we have digital assets that are abandoned, which does happen, for Kentucky to enforce its abandoned property laws, we would be put into a position of either violating securities laws as they were interpreted by the current or the just passed SEC, or we would just simply not be able to enforce our laws. Kentucky, I think, is similar to every other state, is we don't have a digital wallet, you know, created to, if you have abandoned digital assets, that you are going to take those digital assets and store it into a wallet and then sell or put back on the market. It's just not the way that works. Under Kentucky law, the abandoned digital asset is the holder of it, once found, is to liquidate the digital asset into fiat currency. And then that money is then returned to the state to be put toward the public good. And so Kentucky, like any other state, was put into a position to where we were not going to be able to enforce state law based on ill-defined federal enforcement and would allow these digital assets just to sit there. And so what you have is a blatant violation of federalism and separation of powers concepts, where by the SEC, by taking these enforcement actions, particularly without the rulemaking to even put the rules in place, was going to put Kentucky and all other states in a position where we would not be able to enforce our laws and have these things just piling up on us. And so it was one of the, for all the times I fought the Biden administration under the APA, there were some pretty, you know, glaring examples of how they violated the Administrative Procedures Act. And here, what I started to call, and I think others have obviously called, it was regulation by enforcement. You know, it was scattershot. There was no rulemaking. There was no content. And so Kentucky, like other states, were put in a position to where if digital assets are securities, which is the way they were trying to enforce that, then the liquidation of abandoned digital assets would be unlawful. It'd be like the sale of an unregistered security. And so not only is that unpractical, to me, it's just offensive from a federalism and separation of powers standpoint. So I think it gave us a little bit more of a hook to go directly after the SEC on the actual rule and enforcement that maybe the private companies were having to take different shots at.
So Justin, as a quick follow-up, now that we have Paul Adkins coming in to chair the SEC, what are some potential resolutions of this case in your mind?
Well, I think it's tricky because, you know, those lawyers on this who are dealing currently with the DOJ, you know, obviously I think we've had very positive turnover there for a lot of good reasons, but this case is just kind of sitting there. And I think if, you know, it's the end of the day, it's not one that I don't think it's just going to be dismissed or voluntarily withdrawn, because what we're really pushing for are several things, but whether it's by order or agreement, what I'd like to see come out of this particular case is a declaration that a digital asset transaction is not an investment contract. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I think if we can get that in this case, combine that with a declaration that a digital asset platforms that facilitate the secondary transactions are also not to be registered as security or security exchanges. Mm-hmm. I think those two things, one, solve the issues states are up against and not being able to enforce its achievement laws. I do think states have the role of, and not the federal government, of managing these type of assets as they currently exist. So those are the two things I would really like to see come out of this, because I have a hard time thinking that the DOJ under its new leadership is going to want to litigate this out. But also I'm pretty confident saying the states don't want it to just go away without some agreement on those two very pointed things. You know, we can probably get aside the Administrative Procedures Act and some of the other separation of powers issues, but I would love to see an order or an agreement of some sort on those two very big picture things that I think would be the benefit of the entire industry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, not just for this industry, but for industries to come in the future that might be victims of the SEC's overreach. Just broadening this conversation out a little bit, Paul, given your experience at the CFPB back in the last Trump administration, can you talk to us a little bit about the ideal way for regulatory agencies like this to view innovation and engage with new industries? And how did you approach it at the CFPB?
It's a big challenge for Washington, D.C. To deal with innovation. And Washington, D.C. is really not set up to do that well. And you highlighted at the beginning, this enforcement philosophy may have cost one political party a presidential election. And that's why things changed. And frankly, that's too bad, because it's pretty rare for an industry to have enough economic clout that they can potentially swing national elections. But that's what it takes to get on the agenda in Washington, D.C. and get the ear of policymakers. And my takeaway from that is that we need as much innovation as possible at the state level, because that structural impediment is so large. There were a number of innovation offices at different agencies. I ran one of them. You know, there are key themes that innovation offices try to do. You try to meet with different participants who are launching new products. And then very, very rarely, you try to provide regulatory clarity, which is really what the industry needs in order to launch a product. You could also try some kind of testing ground, some kind of sandbox, which creates unique issues, but it's extremely hard for an agency to provide clarity and say, yes, this activity is permitted from a regulatory perspective, even when they're retaining fraud enforcement, which I think the agency always has to do. You always have to be able to go after fraud and deception, which occurs in innovative areas, just like it occurs everywhere else. The agency always has to have that authority. But if they're going to provide clarity around some kind of regulatory requirement and say, no, we're not going to require X, we're not going to require a Y, that really goes against the DNA of an agency. And it's a hard thing to do. And there's not necessarily a lot of pressure to do that, except for this unique circumstance that we're in. And I have to say, the presence of the venture capital community, their interest in regulatory reform is potentially the only force that might be strong enough to balance this out a little bit, because the venture capital community has an interest in continual innovation, not just enough innovation to launch their product and then slam the door.
Yeah, I mean, I think we like to say that we are anti-regulatory capture, in that we stand not just for the founders of today, but the founders of tomorrow and 10 years from now. And I actually do think that's largely true, and that investors can take this very long-term mindset in how we view. So thanks for giving us a plug, Paul. But building on this question about agencies and their approach to innovation, Eric, I know you've got an interest in watching what Commissioner Peirce and Acting Chair Mark Ueda have been doing with the Crypto Task Force over at the SEC. What do you anticipate is going to come out of something like this? And talk us through what you've been seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really important to note that even up until Gary Gensler became chair of the SEC, he had pretty consistently stated publicly that the SEC was the wrong body to be regulating crypto assets. So now he is gone, and the commissioners that are left, soon to be joined by Chair Atkins, are kind of going back to the drawing board. And the statement issued by Commissioner Peirce, The Journey Begins, I think it was on February 4th, lays out a whole bunch of the challenges that the SEC faces. And I think one of the most poignant points is that this enforcement debacle began almost 10 years ago. And when you're on a run and you get dehydrated, you know, they'll tell you it takes you as long to get rehydrated as it took you to get dehydrated in the first place. More artfully than that, I think Commissioner Peirce said something along the lines of, it took us a whole lot to get into this mess. It's going to take a little bit to get out. And part of the reason for that is they want to make sure that they get out in an orderly fashion, to the extent that there are many crypto assets that don't fall under the purview of the SEC. And so now it sounds like they're doing a lot of a listening tour. They're going around. I think I saw this morning that there were many documents and testimonies put before the Crypto Task Force. There's so much to unravel, and that's part of the process going on. There's a lot to do with the ongoing enforcement actions, many of which have been dropped because they are inconsistent. Or they haven't said what the reason is, but presumably the SEC has dropped enforcement actions because they believe they're inconsistent with their authority or prioritization of what type of efforts they should be spending. But at the same time, there likely needs to be some font or some basis to ensure that consumers are being protected, and that in this area where the SEC has tried to occupy the field, that appropriate bodies, whether that be in the federal or state governments, are occupying that space and engaging in a productive, clear, predictable manner to allow founders, venture capital firms, people with an interesting idea, or just some of the crypto people that are putting their fascinating ideas and theories to work on the blockchain, to give them the space to do that in a way that still leaves consumers protected. And so the SEC, I think, is looking first at trying to figure out what is going on, getting its hands around that, and then is going to move on to what's next. And I don't know that the answer for what's next is definitively going to be that the SEC maintains its regulatory oversight in this area. I think that's one potential aspect of it. There was a second statement put out by Commissioner Peirce more recently, and I think that it laid out a really interesting potential taxonomy for crypto assets. It laid out four buckets. First is that crypto assets that are securities, because they have intrinsic characteristics of securities, some crypto assets fit in the Howey test. And I think many people don't object to those securities that clearly fit under the longstanding principles being regulated as securities. Then there's crypto assets that are offered and sold as part of an investment contract. And the investment contract itself is a security, even if the crypto asset itself may not be a security. That's a more complicated question that likely is going to need not only oversight from the SEC, but potentially from other groups or, in the alternative to the SEC, other regulatory bodies. Third is tokenized securities. And then fourth, which importantly, Commissioner Peirce recognizes is the largest category, all other crypto assets, which are not securities. So that is the big question, is what to do with those securities themselves. So I think that seems to be the focus of what the SEC is focusing on now, not to get too circular there, trying to figure out what they're already doing and what is appropriate for them to be doing next. And I guess perhaps under all of this is a backdrop of the potential for some kind of congressional action, because ultimately there is not a perfect fit in the federal government right now for many of these securities. And as this becomes a multi-trillion dollar industry that touches on consumers all across the country, it seems plausible at some point that the political branches might want to get involved directly. Now, I would not bet on that ever, but it's certainly possible at some point that some kind of legislation might get enacted, and that could shift around a whole lot of how we've been looking at things so far.
Eric, we're getting stablecoin legislation in the next 100 days. I'm very confident of that. And we're going to do market structure after that. But
very stable.
Let's do a quick round robin of our panelists here and get everyone's take on a question that just came in from the audience, which is this. Should the SEC maintain jurisdiction over this asset class at all, or given the tangled web of U.S. federal regulatory agencies and financial services, would it make sense for there to be a completely new agency? Just a brief 30 to 60 second answer from each of you. Paul, you want to kick it off?
Yeah, I think the answer is no. The SEC has very specific expertise, essentially, in shares of companies. These products are much more like commodities. They're much more like consumer products. There are other agencies with that expertise, and there are a lot of states that can handle that. So most of this should be outside the SEC.
Eric?
I'm a state SG, hammer, meet, nail. There are so many laws and consumer protection statutes that let states go after scammers and fraudsters. That seems to function in so many areas of life, to the extent that there are people committing scams that happen to be in the crypto space. States should be able to go in and help deal with that. And I will note one aspect that I know is a fundamental part of the lawsuit that Kentucky and Justin have led, that so many of our states have signed onto, is that when the SEC enters a field, there's a real risk of preemption. And the last thing that anyone should want is for the SEC entering a regulatory area, preventing states from being able to engage in their own classic consumer protection regulation. That is an outcome that really seems like a worst of all worlds.
Yeah, agree there for sure. Justin, your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, kind of just following up on what Paul and Eric have already said, but, you know, while we doubt the ability of Congress to actually work, I mean, the first step is for Congress to, if Congress meant for the SEC to have extensive powers over all these financial instruments, including digital assets, Congress would have authored it, and they never have. So I do think there's a role for Congress to get involved here, but also agree with Paul that I don't think it's the SEC. Here, you can go back a few years ago and, you know, there was a little bit of a turf war between the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. If these things, to me, in my opinion, if they're anything, they're commodities, is to be sold. And then I think the biggest thing, too, that if the SEC does want to if they do want to play a role here, and it's consistent with what I think Eric was saying a minute ago, is then let's actually propose rules for crypto. Have go through the rulemaking policy to actually tailor rules to take into account the differences between traditional crypto assets or digital assets and traditional securities. Because perhaps there are examples of some of these that fit possibly the traditional definition of a security or even investment contract, but not many. And I still argue that they're commodities. But if the SEC wants to take a role here with congressional action, to me, is still the first step, then go through the rulemaking process and let's actually create rules and regulations that provide guidance, because right now there almost is none. So that would be my first three.
If I can just hop on and add one more point to that. One of the real problems with this regulation by enforcement is that not only does no one know what the rules are, but there are mechanisms in the law to allow people or states to challenge rules that are illegal. And it actually is a major impediment to ensuring that federal agencies follow the law when the rule is unstated. And one of the major aspects in any type of Administrative Procedure Act challenge is a final rule. And perhaps it is true that the SEC can't regulate crypto assets because it exceeds their authority. Okay, well, then they shouldn't be doing it at all. And perhaps it's not. And they've got really smart, competent lawyers that can lay out a path that makes sense. Then it's their obligation to do that so that people can see the work they're doing. Because the federal government isn't supposed to operate in the shadows. It's supposed to be transparent. And that's what rulemaking is for.
You know, as they say, Eric, I think that's been a feature and not a bug of the approach for the last 4 years. It's been very purposeful. But looking to the future, what the SEC did to crypto, which is hopefully now in the rearview mirror, is easily applied to other new technologies in the future, and not just at the SEC, but at any other agency, I suppose. So how can we collectively, as Americans who care about administrative overreach, use this moment to prevent future SEC overreach? Is this a major questions doctrine issue? Is this some other thing that we need to collectively realize as an American people? What can we do to place guardrails around agencies to prevent something like this, this war on crypto, from happening ever again? Anyone feel free to jump in.
I'll do
Sorry, go ahead.
Two quick things. One is, people always say when there's a change of administration, live by the executive order, die by the executive order. It's a lot easier to undo executive orders or even rules than to change the law. Well, that's doubly so when they don't even bother to publish a rule in the first place. The SEC has a whole lot of flexibility to change its approach, at least prospectively. Now, that doesn't guarantee a lack of backsliding, but some of these positive and affirmative lawsuits might lay out the path for that. The writ of mandamus that Coinbase won in the Third Circuit is a fascinating case to read. And while it was not a grand slam win for Coinbase, it was three judges appointed by three different presidents with very different jurisprudential approaches who all agreed that the extraordinary writ of mandamus was appropriate because the SEC had erred so much. And while they stopped short of ordering the SEC to engage in rulemaking, they hinted pretty strongly that that is the appropriate path if they want to continue regulating here. To the extent that the SEC is trying to figure out the best way forward for itself in this space, I think that its current approach with the task force and talking to all the folks that are involved in that industry is very smart and very prudent. And, you know, a lot will depend on how they decide to take next steps. And just one final point, just to get back to the beginning of your question about the major questions doctrine. There's some really great literature that have been coming out on this. Obviously, it's a longstanding doctrine that's only been recently explicitly recognized in the jurisprudence. The Supreme Court has said that major economic rules that affect billions of dollars are major questions. Well, this potentially affects regulation of trillions of dollars. So to the extent that figuring out the lines of where the major questions doctrine ends and the gray area around the edges might be a very complicated endeavor, this seems like it isn't a close call at all. And so to the extent that an agency is arrogating power to itself to the exclusion of what Congress has authorized it to regulate, That is such an overreach, especially when it comes to an entirely new industry, that I imagine that when the question is eventually squarely presented, courts are going to rule on it and find that it is too much, at least given how they've approached it so far.
Mm-hmm. Paul or Justin, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just add that we need a path to innovation that transcends partisanship, and we can't get that if the path has to go through Washington, D.C. And that's even more true now and in the future than it has been in the past. And the reason is because there's now a lot of court decisions allowing the president even more control over independent agencies to replace the directors, to centralize rulemaking. So one party is going to control all of the agencies and make this kind of coordinated war on crypto through banking agencies and everything much easier in the future. And so when there's legislation being proposed, and I think the stablecoin legislation is a good example, you can't have exclusive federal licensing because that's going to be captured. We know it's going to be captured. We know any federal licensing scheme will be used to kill innovation. It always has, it always will. So there needs to be independent and equal authority that can be used by states as disparate as New York and Wyoming, because you can't politically capture New York and Wyoming. The same party can't do that. And so we need those paths to be able to transcend politics, and that means we need disparate licensing.
Paul, I've never heard such an inspiring defense of federalism. That was beautiful. Justin?
not too much to add, particularly from Eric. I think he and I are coming to a lot of this from the same kind of same point of view, being in state AG's offices. But I will say, to the extent there is any role from Congress or the SEC or even the Commodities Trading Commission, it needs to be consistency. You know, that right now there's, you know, we can go back to even Gensler. I think it was X number of years ago, had stated that, you know, Bitcoin was not a security to be regulated by the SEC. And then by the early 2020s had completely reversed a lot of those and started prosecuting digital asset platforms, Coinbase, Robinhood, for not being registered, even though there's no congressional action mandating registration, and nor was any SEC proposed rulemaking. So it really just comes back down to the theme of maybe there is a role for Congress, but to the extent the SEC is going to take any actions here, there just needs to be open, consistent rulemaking. Although I do agree with Paul's overall theme of it just really isn't for the SEC anyway.
So we're starting to get some great audience questions rolling in. Feel free to start putting more into the chat for those of you in the audience. Let me start from one that we got a few minutes ago related to something that Commissioner Peirce has frequently talked about, which is that tokens can actually become more decentralized over time and look less and less like investment contracts over time. Paul, why don't you talk us through this concept and how much decentralization, like, you're ultimately shooting for in the end?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a tough call. I guess I would say initially, this is, I think, a stricter test than you might expect. Just because something is being sold and somebody expects to make a profit, that's not an investment contract. And again, there's a lot of activity that Nike engages in to increase the value of his shoes. It doesn't make Nike, doesn't have to issue an S-1 when they sell new shoes. So again, we have to look at the regulatory structure. Is this enough of an investment contract that the most relevant information to the purchaser is the financial condition of the Ethereum Foundation? I doubt it. That's pretty much irrelevant. Certainly if the project becomes more decentralized, where the foundation and the issuer and those activities are not driving value, then that's easy to say, okay, that's not a security. But I think that element is present pretty early, and the degree of decentralization might occur pretty quickly.
Paul, going back to one of the points you were making earlier about the need for both federal and state interlocking regulatory regimes to avoid capture, Can you talk to me a little bit about how these things should actually relate to one another? How should state and federal authorities and regulations interact on things related to innovation? It's a big nebulous question, so feel free to take it wherever makes sense.
Yeah, so I think there's some elements of SEC jurisdiction that already relate to that. You know, we used to have regional underwriters. We used to have offerings that were available in a limited number of states, and the benefits of that have been eroded over time. So I think one thing the SEC could do is make it very easy to launch a product within a limited number of states, and make it very easy for states to coordinate around the regulatory structure that they want to impose, because the way the SEC is going to draft rules, and I'm glad they're doing this, they're going to take a bunch of comments, they're going to think about what makes sense, and then they're going to put something out, and that'll be a huge step forward. But boy, for the past decade, we could have been testing actual rules and actual disclosures within different markets in this country, with consumers who were backed by fraud protection, who knew they were engaging in something risky, who knew that this was at the early stages maybe akin to gambling, who were only using money that they could lose. And we would have a lot of data to know exactly how to structure these things. We don't have any of that now. So we have to launch this at a national scale with consequences that aren't entirely foreseen. And the regulators could put us in a much better situation by encouraging states to move ahead and develop these structures. I think the states are willing to do it, but for some reason, it's very hard for an agency to give them those green lights.
And, you know, obviously, one of the main purposes of the litigation that the 18 state attorneys general brought was to maintain some area where states could actually have some enforcement authority. Let's talk a little bit about what some of the areas are that the state attorneys general have been tackling. And Eric, your boss has looked into, for example, Bitcoin ATMs. I'd love to hear from both you and Justin about what are some of the specific concrete things that your offices might be looking at with respect to crypto consumer protection.
Well, there is a whole lot on this front. I think actually the timing of this is probably just a touch premature, but I imagine if you follow along with my office's press releases in the near future, you will likely see some concrete action as far as the consumer protection side of what it looks like in the crypto space. And apologies if you hear a ringing behind me, there was a fire alarm going off. And so that might be,
Eric, don't endanger your life just for this webinar. If you need to exit, please do.
Yeah, no, I think it's just a false alarm. But just in case you hear some noise, I wanted to give you a heads up. That said, there is a lot that states can do. And I think you will see the states are going to start doing it and soon. And that there is a real difference between the crypto industry and fraudsters and scammers that are using crypto as a fig leaf for their bad activities. So keep your eye on that space.
Justin, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this one as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit similar, and I thought this might come up because in our consumer protection division, this is something that we're working on internally and is a little bit of a working group with some other states on how best to both, is there a need to update any of our statutes, you know, our consumer protection statutes, or is it just more of a coming up with a plan and information sharing with other states on how best to protect citizens from the fraudsters or bad actors in the space? I'm hesitant to go into any detail on it because we haven't made any of it public just yet. And I think Eric might be in a similar spot, but that's forthcoming and it's pretty interesting. And what the lawsuit we filed here in Kentucky with the help of many other states and the talented lawyers at Clement Murphy, I don't want to leave them out, in putting that lawsuit together is, I remember my boss, the Attorney General, is not super active on X. And our press folks put the announcement of the lawsuit out and it got circulated around. But then all of a sudden, we noticed that the story had been picked up by several large accounts on X that I would not call traditional Republican accounts, but they were really happy about the lawsuit and championing it. Whereas the Courier Journal, the largest newspaper in Louisville, you know, they're their story on this might have got 212 views. I'm not kidding. Whereas one of these accounts from one of the crypto industry accounts had over 1 million impressions by the end of that day. And when I relayed that to our attorney general and to some of my friends in our general assembly, our legislative body, that really got their attention of kind of what Paul was saying earlier about the effect of the election. You know, not this wasn't a sole effect, but you had a lot of people coming out of the woodwork saying, hey, there's one side actually trying to protect our industry and trying to get rules and real regulations in place. So whatever we come up in the consumer protection space, I think we're going to be able to get it done, whether it needs to be a new statutory scheme or, you know, regulations or just simply, you know, internal policies and procedures that we in some of the states can go. Because it was one of the first times that you saw the old, kind of the old media and old guard and new here in Kentucky, which we're always a little bit behind on that. But seeing the attention this lawsuit got and the need for state action in it, I think you're going to see some pretty interesting and aggressive things coming out of not just Kentucky, but most other states.
Awesome. One more plug for submitting questions as we run out of time here. But to close out, I have one big meaty question I would love to hear from all of you on, and it's this. We've reached the time-honored moment in American history when the parties flip sides. And so now we have a lot of Democratic attorneys general who are trying to figure out how they're going to be approaching the Trump administration and the Adkins SEC. Whether it's on crypto or the agency's approach to crypto, or frankly, feel free to broaden it out to any other topic that you expect the SEC to tackle in the coming months and years. How do you think the Democratic attorneys general are thinking about this opportunity and what's likely taking place behind closed doors as they think about their approach?
Well, I guess I'll start off in saying that I assume that the primary driver for at least some of the Democratic attorneys general is the fact that cryptocurrencies use electricity. And unless it's fully certified to be wind and solar powered, they probably oppose it on that front alone. The SEC also decided to dabble in greenhouse gas disclosure rules in the last administration. That is definitely an area of interest for Democrat attorneys general. It seems to me so far that rather than focus on any bread and butter issues, that the Democrat AGs are really going all in on engaging in culture war conflicts against the current administration, trying to push and break all sorts of norms and standard processes. And eventually, I assume they'll get to the idea of what to do, if anything at all, about cryptocurrencies. But at least so far, as there hasn't been any rulemaking, there's just a task force, it seems unlikely that they're going to want to get too involved here. And as, you know, various people on this call have mentioned, there is a large constituency that is passionate about cryptocurrencies and crypto assets. And it would be ill-advised, I would think, for any AG of any party to engage in the issue without doing diligence and being thoughtful about putting their best foot forward. And that's something that I know our office has taken really seriously to engage and to try to engage only up to the point where we are comfortable and understand the limited set of issues while recognizing that when you're dealing with an entire multi-trillion dollar industry that has in effect come out of nowhere in the last 15 years, there is going to be more that we don't know than there necessarily is that we do know, and trying to be humble while still being proactive and trying to address the problems as they arise, as we foresee that they arise, but also trying to be respectful of the fact that there's just a whole lot that we don't know, and trying not to get too far out ahead of our skis on that.
I'll be a little bit more optimistic, I guess. When I was in Trump 1, the Democrat AGs, Democrat states were not a big problem with innovation issues. And I think it speaks to the competitive pressures at the state level. I could talk to New York DFS. I could talk to California Banking Department. The folks who led that were very easy to work with, maybe had a little bit different of a perspective. So, you know, will a Democrat AG come in and try to say, file a lawsuit and say this is a security under state law and therefore we can undermine what the SEC is doing under federal law? Maybe. Maybe we'll be able to find one, but I don't see that initiative being something that is very popular with a large number of states, because I think a lot of state officials want to grow their state economy in a way that folks in DC kind of don't care, because they think the U.S. doesn't have to compete anymore, I guess. But folks at the state level, I think, are aware of that competitive pressure. You know, the BIT license in New York was a disaster. It didn't work and they had to go back and fix it. And that's New York. That's as blue as it gets. And so that makes me optimistic.
Ben?
Yeah, I don't really have too much to add to that, because I've not heard anything from, you know, any working groups that Democrat AGs are going to be tackling this space. Eric's point about the environmental issues were interesting, because I do know Kentucky is trying to make a lot of investments and has made a lot of investments on attracting data mining, data companies, but, you know, Bitcoin mining here in Kentucky because of pretty affordable power. And then to Paul's point, I can't imagine what political points they're going to score by tackling this issue. I mean, this is broad based. I just can't imagine it coming up. I've been surprised by them before, so I'm not going to write that in stone, but I'd be very surprised.
Excellent. Well, on that note, thank you to our amazing participants, Eric, Paul, and Justin. And thank you to Caroline for coordinating this event. We appreciate the chance to talk to you about it. And hopefully there will be more conversations like this to come.
And thank you, Katie, for moderating. This has been a really fascinating discussion for me. And I feel like I'm pretty deep in all this stuff.
Great. Well, I'll just give us our official wrap up. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.